please, you know, if you have to go do your laundry or cook something or, you know, clean out the cat box this morning, this is probably a good opportunity to do it. We don't have a good guest today, so you're stuck with Mark and me. You may want to, you know, you may want to turn this off, but you may want to stick around if you're interested in the top 10 Bible myths. Stay tuned. This really is going to be worth listening to. Watch out. Mark and I are already laughing our heads off. So this may be, it may be funny to you, but it's definitely funny to us and therefore may not be funny to you. But yeah, today is going to be fun. We just decided to do this. I think we're going to do it from time to time where we just kind of have a conversation. You got two Bible answer men here, and we're going to just throw out 10 of the most egregious. Would you say they're egregious, Mark?
I'm still laughing about how much can you undersell the podcast? you don't want to listen to this one. Oh, my God.
Well, you know.
But yes, egregious is a perfect word.
These are egregious scandalous. Bible myths.
Scandalous.
They distort our theology. You know, and I'm already thinking, Mark, after this one, we're going to have to do one, you know, in a few months, the top 10 hymns with the worst theology in them. How about that?
I have a number one already in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well,
I do.
We'll just that's the teaser for the next thing. So, yeah, so that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to pop off 10 of the most egregious Bible myths that are out there, and we're going to dispel all of them. We're going to explain, and we even have – we're calling in – guest expertise as well. So that's kind of going to be fun. Stay tuned. And as always, we have a sponsor this week. This week, our sponsor is, did you eat a lot of breakfast cereal when you were a kid, Mark?
That was our go-to breakfast. It was that or I made cinnamon toast. That's the only thing I could make when I was growing up.
And you heeded the advice that was always given on the commercial that the cereal was a part of a good balanced breakfast, right? So you didn't you ate the cereal, but you also ate the beef jerky, the dried fruit, the
beef jerky,
you know, all that to balance it all
part
out,
of your
right?
healthy
yeah,
breakfast.
Yeah, you did that. I know you did that
with skim milk, no doubt. And I always thought people who put bananas in their cereal when we were growing up, it was always like, they'd show fruit in the cereal. It was always bananas. And I thought that was just, that's just wrong. Grotesque.
Yeah, because everybody knows that bananas belong on top of grits. You know, that's. Or not.
Grits. The tofu of the South. Whatever you add to it is what it tastes like. That's just. I've never been, Southern as I am, I have never been a grits person.
Oh, well, it may not surprise you that I have taken to searching out, you know, the best gourmet grits.
Of course you have, because why wouldn't you?
Yes. As I, this is what you do when you, you know, like tour the nation's Cracker Barrel stores or you, you know... The Amish markets, whatever, you look for things, specialty items. And I've tried a few different brands of kind of, you know, high-end grits. But you know what? Nothing is better than Quaker old-fashioned grits in a can, in my opinion.
It reminds me of a comment that Garrison Keillor once made about pumpkin pie. He said, you know, the best pumpkin pie you ever had wasn't that much different from the worst pumpkin pie you ever had. Grits, let's face it, that framework of the best grit and the worst grit is pretty tight in terms of the... Oh, I grade that as an 87. Oh, I grade that one as an 88. I mean, it's how... we're not talking blue ribbon.
See, folks,
here.
This is what I was saying at the beginning. You may not want to hang around for this one, but I do have to say that it only goes uphill from here. It only goes up from here.
That's true.
So what's going on at the church these days, Mark? What's happening?
Actually, wonderful things are floor. I'm staring down over the newly refinished multi-purpose room floor. We had a guest on not long ago, Mike Corcoran, talking about building and maintenance, and that's a perfect example. The cost of refinishing that floor was $2,600, and we said, no, we don't want to do that. Mike, in his expertise, found us $185 bucket of the same refinishing stuff, and he just did it. He and his team did it. Fantastic job. So there's that going on. There is preparations for our new stewardship campaign, and frankly, really exciting. We always send out letters to our leadership and say, hey, can you just make your estimate of giving early so we can start the campaign off with a boom, your leaders have come back. And I purely out of nowhere said, oh, I think we should shoot for 33% of the budget. Wouldn't that be great? If we could start the campaign saying your leaders have already made their estimates of giving for next year and we're at 33%. Thinking the whole time, well, I don't see that happening. That's a stretch goal. I was so excited. Linda informed us yesterday it was at 35%. We've already reached 35% of our goal.
The way I encountered that news was seeing it in the chat, you know, the team's chat that we have in the church staff. And I saw your response was, I believe it was, wow, wow, wow. I believe it's three wows.
I was going to say, it's like holy, holy, holy. The
wow,
more you say
wow,
it, the more emphasis
wow,
it gets.
Wow, wow, wow. It only gets better from here.
Well, you keep saying that. Eventually, it'll be true. We're also preparing for our outdoor worship on October 30th. So thinking one worship service that morning at 11 o'clock in the front lawn. Those who want a lawn chair can bring them. Those who are afraid of walking on the grass and the lawn. We have some people that just had surgery. Right. They don't want to walk out there. We have chairs available, and you can stay on the parking lot, but it's always great to be together.
Well, and here's outside. The thing. I just got off the I talked to Shelby this morning, Shelby Fowler, our children's ministries director, and you know, Shelby's a little nervous about this. She's a little nervous that we have enough volunteers to do this, and really nervous about people doing the trunk or treat part. Trunk or treat is such a popular thing, and people, I'm quite convinced that people from all over the area will come to our trunk or treat if we offer it. But right now, we don't have very many people signed up to do it. So you know,
that's right. That's right. And we have had great trunk or treats in the past, so send the word out through all your people that if you can provide a trunk or treat.
Yeah, so let's just say this, you know, let's say that the listeners to this podcast are probably the elite members of the congregation, the most committed members of the congregation and the community.
Be committed to
and
listen
therefore,
to this.
You right. know, I think it's an easy appeal to that if you're listening to this today, I fall short of saying that you are called of God to have a trunk or treat trunk, but you know it's a big deal, right? You're part of the elite in this church, and so you know we think you're being called to step up and provide, and you don't have to have a big elaborate decoration. Everybody wants to do it. Everybody sees it as this competition, but it's definitely not. You can just open up your trunk, sit there, and hand out candy. That's the hospitable thing to do, right? And that's really what this is all about, is hospitality.
I mean, when you were a kid, did you only go to the houses that were decorated? No, you took your pillowcase to any house you could get to, and that would offer you a tree.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
I remember that year when my kids, you know, four kids, when they were just at the age that they kind of had things figured out, they went around the neighborhood to all the hot spots, and I remember that we weighed their candy when we got back. And you know how much candy they brought home?
No.
My four children brought a total of 70 pounds of candy.
I love that. I love that image.
Now,
of Chris and the triplets sitting down, dividing it out, and then trading. I'll give you a Zagnut for that Snickers. You know, you have to trade it. That's the fun part. You get back and say, oh, my gosh, who's giving out toothbrushes? That's just wrong. That conversation afterwards, toothbrushes and those little now-or-laters. Little tiny hour later.
Well, yeah. I think it's time to wrap this portion of the podcast up. I think we're actually over that time because we're undisciplined today. But let's just go out there on a limb and say, hey, lots going on and lots of exciting stuff. It's I really think in a lot of ways there's kind of a rebuilding that's going on, but it's so cool to see it all happen. You know, see everything. Churches everywhere are rebuilding after the pandemic, and some are handling it pretty well, and some aren't. But this church seems to be on top of it.
Yeah. We are. We are very blessed. Great people, good staff. We're right where we want to be.
And your communications director is, well, okay, so you want to jump into it? You ready to jump into it?
Okay.
I'd say you go first. You go first.
Okay. We'll start at the big, since we're talking about biblical myths, biblical misconceptions. I'm going to start at the very beginning. And that would be, of course, we all know, we've seen the movies, Adam and Eve commit sin by eating an apple. Oh, nay, nay. You might remember what, okay, for those of you who really, this is one of those classic examples of how often people think they know the Bible and they talk about the Bible, but they don't actually read the Bible.
Amen, brother.
And it just drives me crazy.
It's Amen. Not that hard to read, right? I mean, it's a book. We can read it. It's, you know, we don't have to read about it.
And
we
in
can
this case,
read.
It's from the, we can, and most people have one in their home or on their phone. This is in Genesis chapter 2. The Lord God looked at the man and the woman in the Garden of Eden and gave them an opportunity to not eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It just says fruit. And frankly, let's be honest, Steve, if you were going to be tempted to eat something, would it be an apple or would it be a mango?
I think definitely a mango.
See, I agree. I think a mango, a really nice mango or... Gosh, so many
figs
options
are
there.
Good.
What fruit would be the
I
most?
I like figs, and that's a very biblical thing. Biblical fruit, yeah.
Yep.
Pears are good. Pears are, what would it be like if we had all those paintings of Adam and Eve, Eve offering Adam a pear?
Yeah. So many options. So there you go. Read the Bible. Don't just talk about it. You can actually look things up for yourself. Adam and Eve ate a fruit, and you get to figure out what works for you in terms
and
of
that.
And
that also leads us to, I have to bring up the issue. This is not one of the 10 myths, but it's just, you know, read chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis, and you will see fairly, I think it's pretty obvious, don't you, Mark, that
yes.
it's
oh,
right there in
I
front
agree.
Of you that there are two creation stories. It's like one is, you know, the one, hey, you know, how does it go? I forget. I was about to pull the opening chapter of John, which
the
is
the first yeah, creations.
I was about to say in the beginning
the
was the word,
story.
But that's John. So yeah, that was
that's
about to
John,
pull that.
Yeah.
First creation story.
But the first creation story in which God creates by speaking. Everything is, you know. And the Lord said, let there be light, and there's light. People are actually last. It's all the earth and then the animals, and people are last. And they're made male and female at the same time. That's the Genesis story it says. And they were made in the image of God, male and female God created them. It's the second creation story where actually people are made first and then animals later. And then that's Adam, which, by the way, that word Adam that we translate Adam, it's a play on the Hebrew. Adam has to do with the earth. Adam meaning red earth. And so that's, instead of being created by speaking, God in the second creation story, which begins chapter 2, verse 4, takes red earth and molds it with some water that rises up out of the ground and then breathes life into it. In other words, the creation is done by pottery. You know, it's molding someone and breathing life into it. So it's a completely different way to create, different story, but it's amazing how many people...
I think I might have heard the complaint that, oh, you're just being one of those scholar people. You're just being picky. It's not really there. You're just making stuff up just to confuse people, make it more difficult. And it should be, you should just go with the plain reading of it. And I'll offer it. Yeah, let's go for that. Read it. Read it with a plain reading and just read it and you will see it. You will not, it's not something that we just kind of, you know, made up because we went to seminary and all, you know, it's there. It's obvious. Okay. Are we ready to move on?
All right. I am ready.
Let's see. I want to take on this issue about one of the great myths of the Bible, that the Psalms were written by King David.
Dryer sound. Yeah, I love that sound.
It's the best buzzer sound I could find. It's kind of anemic, but it's okay. But that's also related to the Bible myth that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Okay, so we're going to tackle that one, and I need some help because I'm very familiar with the arguments around the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. See, we have a technical term for that. But the whole thing about King David writing the Psalms, I mean, where did that come from, and why is that something that's even important? I don't know.
No, it's very important because in the Hebrew mindset, you wanted to honor, it's a tribal mindset. So the Jewish people, all through, especially the Pentateuch, have this tribal understanding that you want to honor whoever the first person was that did something, you wanted to honor them. So Moses was the lawgiver. So all laws are laws of Moses. And that's why King James, if you go back, that's where it came from. If you go back to read the King James Version, it says in the title page, Genesis, the first book of Moses. And so people went, oh, well, Moses must have written that one. No, those first five books, to use that word that Steve used, are the Pentateuch. They're books of the law. So a way of honoring Moses was to say any book of the law is a book of Moses. And so, no, Moses did not write the first five books any more than David wrote all the Psalms, but David was the one great psalmist. He did write a lot of them. And so all Psalms are therefore Psalms of David. You see this, you know what's really interesting? People get this when you make this connection. The book of Hebrews talks about Jesus is a priest in the order of Melchizedek. And you would naturally, that plain and simple reading that you're talking about, if you had a plain and simple reading of the Bible, you'd say, oh, well then Melchizedek must be more important than Jesus. No. Genesis 14, Melchizedek was the first priest. Therefore, all priests of God are priests of Melchizedek. It has nothing to do with being superior or inferior. That's just a priest of that first person. And so all Psalms are Psalms.
Yeah, so I want to do another side of that is that we're talking about tribal customs and ancient customs, which are very different in a lot of ways than our customs today. So we look at the New Testament books and say, oh, well, you know, Paul wrote this. This is a letter of Paul. Paul wrote it. Well, it's the same principle. Paul didn't write all of them, and it's pretty well agreed that he didn't write Ephesians at all, okay? But if you were in, if you were one of Paul's community, if you're a member of Paul's community, and you wrote something that was clearly his thought and his teaching and in line with his teaching, you would never, ever, ever say, well, this is the letter of Steve. You would be anonymous. You would say, nope, this is Paul's thinking. And actually, you know, one of the terrifying things about the Bible is that it was assembled by a committee. All the books of the Bible were assembled by a committee. That's the Council of Nicaea in the early 4th century. And they had to go and kind of figure out, you know, there were a lot of little books out there, books and letters that purported to be of, you know, these communities, Paul's community, Peter's community, et cetera. And they had to kind of do some detective work to figure out if they were legit part, you know, of those communities. And they didn't really care about, was this actually written by Paul? Was the Gospel of John really written by John? It was part of a community that had credence in the early church, and that's what's really important. Yeah.
Yeah, a disciple of John or a disciple of Paul wrote them. And you see that even in Paul's writings. Paul and Silas went around doing things.
So are we going to dive deep into the five books of the Bible and talk about the JDEP theory and all of that, redaction criticism?
No.
We're not going to do that.
No, I love that stuff, yeah. And I am all over that stuff. But no, we don't have time for that. That's a whole different podcast.
That's one we would definitely need to pass on.
It would only get better from here if we went
all
down
right.
that path. Okay, so third misconception. Jesus was born, well, we all know Jesus was born on December 25th in the year zero.
What? That's wrong?
Don't be messing with Christmas, man. You talk about the hordes coming down upon you.
You
don't mess with Christmas.
Y2K was a few years off?
Yeah, that's always the fun part of this one. Okay, first of all, the answer is no. Here's a good trivia. Do you know who came up, who labeled year zero, who decided Jesus was born, and then they started, you know, nobody in Jesus, like when growing up, nobody was sitting around going, well, it's 12 AD now. So, you know, they didn't know that stuff. So who went backwards and said that was zero, so today is 500 AD?
Who did it?
It's a guy named Dionysius Exiguus in the year, what he decided was the year 525. It turns out he was a little bit wrong.
Interesting.
Now we know, given all the records, our best guess. Do you remember this? That you hear different things with different versions.
Yeah, so
it.
Here's the thing. Excuse me. The book, the Gospels pinned the date down pretty well. I mean, at least the year, right? And I believe it's the Gospel of Luke says that, you know, times out the visitations and stuff, and that he names that Herod the Great was, you know, right. was...
In those days, a decree went out from Emperor Augustus that all the world should
right?
be registered.
Which, by the way, there's no archaeological evidence of that. No historical evidence of that at all. But one of the Gospels, I can't remember if it's, I know it's not Mark and I know it's not John, but it's either Matthew or Luke, you know, actually says, well, you know, then this happened and it was, I think it was Herod Antipas that was, anyway, mm-hmm. the date of, no, it was Herod the Great who died in what, 6 BC?
Yep.
And Herod was the one who did the, you know, the murder of the innocents and all that. And so therefore, how could Jesus have been born in 0 AD if Herod was already dead by then? That's the logic.
And so the bottom line is we think that Dionysius or whatever his name was in 525 was off by about 6 or 7 years. So Jesus was actually born in 6 or 7 BC. BC.
Yeah. And the date December 25th is really not historical either. It's just tied to kind of, you know, the winter solstice festivals, right?
Exactly, which is actually one of my favorite stories that people don't understand when they get really upset over, well, what do you mean Christmas didn't happen on that exact day? Well, it's the same reason. Have you ever wondered why we name the celebration of Jesus' resurrection Easter? That's not a biblical word. Where'd that come from? Well, you don't have to get all conspiratorial about it. It was the early church trying to reach out into a community that they thought could understand who Jesus was if they adopted some language. And so the goddess Oester, which was a part of that culture they were in, had a celebration of new life that was tied to spring. Springtime, we celebrate Oester. And all the early church said was, oh, you think new life matters? Oh, let us tell you about what really new life is. And so they labeled their celebration Easter to make that connection. In the very same way, Christmas, we weren't sure when Jesus was born. So the early church looked up and said, when do we want to celebrate the birth? Well, there's this wonderful pagan festival around the winter solstice. Oh, you really want to hear about light entering the darkness? Boom, let us tell you about Jesus.
Right, and also that whole idea of light entering the darkness, that's really what we're talking about. We're not trying... ancient people didn't think in these kinds of, you know, all this date and this kind of scientific way that we think. Science in the way that we understand it today is only like 500 years old. So how it's very important to understand not so much the science, the scientific, you know, pinning down of the day so I can celebrate Jesus's birthday on time, that kind of thing. It's really about connecting the big idea of Jesus with the big idea of what's going on out there in the world, right?
That's exactly right. It was an evangelical desire to reach out into the world that we say, this is when we're going to celebrate Christmas. Because the world cares about light coming into the darkness. The world cares about new life. How do we connect? And it's really the product of Christendom when we think we run everything that we forget those origins, that we were trying to do a good thing.
So I think that now it's time, before we get into our commercial break, which I know is why most people watch this or, you know, listen to this this podcast, I think we need to tackle one question that requires expertise that neither you nor I have.
Boy, you have nailed it. Here's the statement that people will make quite often, you'll hear, especially idiot preachers make. Mary Magdalene was a prostitute.
Yeah.
I'm waiting on the buzzer.
I was off my game.
I'll just start doing it myself.
I like yours better.
Okay, here we go.
I got a lot of problems with you people.
So, yeah.
You're going to hear about it.
So this is one of those that I completely believe that this is a myth and it's wrong, but I have the hardest time remembering the historicity of why this became a myth.
And we have a member of our staff, one of the pastors, who really has something to say about this, right? So this is Denna, and I'm going to call Denna and hope that she answers the phone and can hear this conversation. I don't know.
Reverend,
may or may not.
I can hear that. The Reverend.
Can she hear you?
I don't know. Denna, can you hear
me?
Hi,
Mark. I can. Can you hear me?
That's, yeah. So we're good. Yep. This is we're trying something new.
Excellent.
This is going to mean that we can have callers call in people on our show now. So that's what that
Very
means.
Nice.
That's rather frightening. Well, the Reverend Denna Hornby, who joined us in our congregation in July 1st. We're so excited that you're coming in as the expert witness. I can never remember the historical background for that myth of Mary Magdalene as a prostitute. We know it's wrong.
It is wrong.
But remind us.
Okay, it's important to say that Mary Magdalene was not a prostitute. That myth first began in the year 591 when Pope Gregory I preached his Easter homily. And in that homily, he referred to her as this repentant prostitute, this promiscuous woman. Now, later in about 1969, Pope Paul tried to fix that. But as is typical many times, once a rumor is out, it sticks. and it's hard to pull it back in. And so it's important to know that she was not a prostitute. What she was a faithful and beloved disciple of Jesus Christ.
And I love that. It's so typical, isn't it? The preacher screwing it up by trying to make a point and expanding what the Bible says. I actually had Stella Roberts' husband, Sam, once came up to me after a sermon I preached here and said, "I really enjoyed your sermon. I never let the gospel get in the way of a good sermon."
Oh, harsh.
Oh, snap.
Yeah. But well taken. He was right.
Oh, that's harsh. That's harsh.
So, Mark, a couple of things to know about Mary is that she's the second most mentioned woman in the New Testament after Mary, the mother of Jesus. There are many references to her in the New Testament, but not in relation to another person. For example, you know, women in this time didn't have a lot of rights, and they were referred to as someone's wife or mother or sister. Mary was never referred to in relation to another person. She's just called Mary of Magdala. And so what that implies is that she actually was a person of prominence. She was from Magdala, which was a commercial fishing town on the northwest bank, I think, of the Sea of Galilee. And she left her home to follow Jesus. And from all indications, she was instrumental in funding his ministry.
Wow, that's excellent. I love that little tidbit. That's really
important. It's also proof that men should never talk about this, that we need to sit and learn.
Well, she was faithful until the end. And in every gospel, you're going to see that. From Matthew 28 to Mark 16 to Luke 24 to John 20. And I think for me, the most profound moment is when she sees Jesus. There, she thinks he's a gardener, and he says to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And then she knows, and she calls out Rabboni, you know, rabbi or teacher. And wouldn't it be wonderful, instead of for all these years, for these centuries, instead of calling her a prostitute, we would have referred to her as the woman who said, "I have seen the Lord."
Amen.
I think we need to close this out, close this podcast out now with a word of prayer, as I think, as irreverent as Mark and I tend to be, I think Denna has brought us to the throne of grace here. So we thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Denna, for joining us.
So Denna, I just wanted, I don't know if you've actually, you know, listened to this podcast before. If you haven't,
I have.
If you have, then you know what's coming next, right? It's time to give a shout out to our sponsor, and you're welcome to stay on. Actually, if I know you have things to do, but if you want to stay on, you're welcome to do that. To tackle some of these other Bible myths that we're going to try to destroy.
But thank you, friends. But I will make my exit, and I am grateful to both of you for doing this work. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that didn't go as I had hoped, but.
Blessings and blessings. We need somebody that will bring, you know, real real intelligence and biblical thought to this process. But no, but go ahead. I'll talk to you later. Thanks a lot.
I will say this as a parting word. If anyone listening to this wants to have more conversation about Mary of Magdala, I would welcome that. Call me. We'll go to lunch. We'll have coffee. We'll start a small group. Whatever you like, we'll make it happen. So thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you.
Heck yeah, that's great. Thanks.
Thank you, dear. Thanks,
okay, bye.
All right.
Yeah, bye. That didn't go as I had hoped at all. I kind of think that's, yeah.
She's so good. We're so lucky.
Okay, so.
She keeps us grounded into, like, you know, God and the Bible and stuff like that. That's so nice.
It is.
All right, so our sponsor, who, pray tell, you mentioned breakfast cereal.
So,
who, pray tell,
is
our sponsor?
What was your favorite?
Oh, I'll tell you my three. I had three that I would. That was the tough call. It was Captain Crunch is the immediate first answer. Fruit Loops.
First of all, okay, go ahead.
Fruit Loops and then Frosted Flakes. Those three, hands down, my favorite breakfast cereal.
Captain Crunch. Where do you stand on Crunch Berries?
No. Unnecessary.
We can
original. I'm such the old curmudgeon. It's original
we can
Captain
no longer
Crunch.
Be friends. Okay, so then Fruit Loops. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. The best of the cereals to eat dry. Dry Loops, man. That's
how about
that's good living
how
right
about
there.
Lucky Charms? Did you have anything to say about Yucky Charms? No.
We never bought
I understand
them.
Now that you can just get the charms without the
Yeah, that's called marshmallows, right? They
part
sold
of a
those
balanced
for a long
breakfast.
Time, didn't they? Yeah, exactly. Balance with I don't know something
mine
nutritious.
Was, mine, I loved. Do you remember the box with the frog on it?
Yes, Honey Smacks.
Well, they were first called Sugar
Honey
Smacks. Right, they had to change it because you know sugar got it. Kind of a bad rap there for a while, and that bad rap continues,
oh,
of course. So it had to change to Honey Smacks a little better. Yeah,
honey, yeah. Natural. Anything natural is good for you, like cyanide. It's that whole, you know, if it's natural, it's good. That just cracks
sugar,
me up.
Yeah.
So yes, Honey
sugar,
Smacks,
formerly known as Sugar Smacks, that was good. Well, today we're really honored to have our sponsor. We're sponsored by a breakfast cereal. I mean, I feel like that's really stepping it up a bit, even more than some of ours before. Okay. So let's just roll with that, okay? Oh, wrong button. See, which of these buttons did I assign this to? I think it's this one.
Say, kids, what's real bad for you but tastes real good?
Sugar!
And what gives you excess energy to drive mom crazy?
Sugar!
What breakfast cereal will you tell mom to buy for you next time you go shopping?
Sugar Shocker!
New super sugar-coated Sugar Shockers are little bits of raw cane drenched in honey and coated with powdered sugar, glucose, fructose, corn syrup, and other natural sweeteners.
And it tastes just like sugar-coated sugar!
Mmm! Right, because there's no yucky vitamins or minerals to spoil your fun. And how does it make you feel?
Like I'm vibrating.
Mommy, let's go get an ice cream.
Mommy, let's watch cartoons.
Mommy, let's play Smurf.
Mommy!
Sugar Shockers! And moms will love Sugar Shockers too. Because inside every box, there's a free bottle of new Flintstones chewable Valium. So try new super sugar-coated Sugar Shockers from your friends at Irresponsible Foods.
Oh, yeah. Love that.
That whole mommy, 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 it literally, it makes me kind of cringe. It's just like, oh, that's a memory right there. Oh,
triggering. Yeah. Triggering. Gosh, sounded like my dinner table every weekday night. Yep.
Well, I have a couple of misconceptions about the Bible that we can whip off really quickly.
All right, let's do it.
Okay?
Let's see. Played the wrong
music.
Number
5, the Lord's Prayer ends with, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory. Amen."
What?
I mean, I know we say that, but that is that last part. If you actually read, it seems like a continuing theme. If you actually go back and read the Bible, when Jesus teaches us the Lord's Prayer in Matthew chapter 5, it doesn't have that ending to it. It's called the doxology that we added later. It ends with, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." Boom. And then in the Catholic liturgy, I forget at what time when that happened, but we added on this doxology at the end, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory." So that's a later
For
addition.
For thine
so that,
is the kingdom. What do you do with that? How are you going to sing that now, Mark? You're that guy.
Well,
you know you those videos. That guy that ruins Adam ruins everything. Have you ever watched those?
Yeah,
Mark ruins everything.
No, Mark, I'm happy to ruin the misconceptions you have about God and
yeah,
the Bible.
And this is important.
Jesus.
Again, you know, it's just one of those ways that I think those of us who have been in church leadership before know this experience, that when you go and tinker with something as sacred as the 23rd Psalm or the Lord's Prayer or the Apostles' Creed, if you use one of them, quote, modern translations, which, you know, are by now older than I am, for sure, you tinker with those things, people get really upset. But what you're really doing,
in fact, you're
what you're trying
right
to
now.
Do right now is you're trying to, you know, kind of bring it back to its original meaning, its original status. Yeah. So again, exactly folks, right. If you don't believe us, look it up. As they say in conspiracy theory circles, do your own research. Do your own.
And by that, they mean don't bother. Just right. Trust us. All right. Another quick misconception we can get beyond: the Bible says God helps those who help themselves.
What are you saying, Mark? You're saying that's not correct?
I'm saying that, no, it's exactly the opposite of what the Bible teaches for the most part. It's that we need one another. We need to be in community. We need to share our gifts, the whole concept of spiritual gifts and being the body of Christ and being together in community is the nature of
it's
the
gospel. It's kind of one of those things where lesson. you can't even say, well, where does it say that, Mark? You know, it's like this is it's so you can't even cite a verse that says the contrary of this because all of it says the contrary exactly. of that. Where did that come from? Do you have any idea? Where did that idea?
My grandfather. That's who it came from. I don't know. I think it's probably that Protestant work ethic that said, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. That completely ignores privilege. That not everybody has boots that have bootstraps on them to pull themselves up by. It's just a Protestant work ethic thing.
Okay, I got one. I want to do one. Can I do one? Please, 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 please. Okay.
Sure.
I want to do this one. The book of Revelations predicts the future.
On so many levels.
We talk about, yeah, we talk about, I mean, how many times have you heard? It's almost like hearing the president say 2 Corinthians. It's, you know, it's not Revelations. There's no S at the end. It's the book of Revelation. Okay. And let's just, I love this topic because, I've taught some classes on how you should read apocalyptic literature in the Bible because it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. Revelation is a very, very developed example of Jewish apocalyptic literature, what's known as Jewish apocalyptic literature. One of the other examples of that is the book of Daniel, and or at least the latter half of the book of Daniel, in which it gets into some interesting visions of. And it's interesting because it is a kind of literature that always emerges from a persecuted community. There's a side of it that's kind of code speak, so that the insiders would understand it, but the outsiders would say, "Oh, this is a bunch of garbage." But in every sense, it is about the bottom line of Revelation is about God being in control. You don't have to worry because God's got this, and you're part of an amazing drama that is unfolding here on earth, but it's really unfolding in heaven. And it's part of, you know, there's a big, you know, big picture connection to all of this, and you're going to be okay. God's going to win. Yeah.
It's really fascinating. If you want a history of what is the correct biblical interpretation of Revelation, I'd recommend to you a book. You can find it on Amazon or anywhere, called Revelation for Today by James Efford, E-F-I-R-D. And he talks about apocalyptic literature and how we have tons of apocalyptic literature not in the Bible, but that was a part of that culture at that time, and how those symbols are really pretty standardized, common symbols, and how it was all screwed up by Plymouth Brethren pastor who didn't have any background in studying Revelation or apocalyptic literature, and he just made it all up, what's in there. He said, this symbol must mean And he started making stuff up. And that book, Revelation for Today, will give you that whole history. And I will say this. This is kind of a half-truth. It doesn't predict the future like, oh, there's an Antichrist and blah, blah, blah. There's a rapture. All that's just made up. The one aspect you could say is it says that in the end, Christ will return and there'll be a judgment. If you by mean there's a predicting a future in that way, then yes, it does say one day in a future, and you can't know when it is, Christ is going to return. Then yes, it's predicting a future. But all that other garbage that you hear that you're tempted to buy books on and go see stupid movies about, that's all trash. And
it's more than just trash. It's harmful trash. It's harmful trash because this, you know, the theories that have emerged out of Revelation, such as the rapture, that is nowhere in the Bible. That is not spoken of. It is something that you can kind of stitch a few passages together and come up with an idea. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess that sounds like that. But it's not in there. It's just not in there. And yet, you know, if there is one narrative that is controlling the destiny of the world and the Middle East specifically, the destiny of the Israelis and the Palestinians and everybody around, it's this idea of the rapture and how it's played out in the ideas of Christian Zionism. So, you know, dumb mistakes in preaching can have very, 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 very large consequences. And we're on a mission, Mark. We are on a mission to absolve or to correct all of those misperceptions and have everyone thinking correctly, right? Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah. I think we have issues with that too. But we'll move on.
We'll move on. Another misconception. And this is one I've been looking forward to. That the names of the three wise men were Gaspar, Melchior, and Balthazar.
First of all, I have to ask a question. Where did we get the idea there were three wise men?
Exactly.
So the Bible, the story just says wise men from the East. So we know, one, they were wise. They were bearing three gifts.
Came bearing three
this
gifts.
This is wise men from the
they
East.
They came bearing three gifts. That's
nowhere says their names. And again, you know, it's not we're just these biblical inerrantists. We just know that, you know, that's the earliest account that we are to look to, and therefore, you know, possibly the most authoritative. That definitely a story that emerged, you know, 1,000 years later is not particularly authoritative. But here's my funny story about this, Mark. Do you remember this? This is so much fun, and this is one of my favorite stories about encountering the truthful spirit of Mark Flynn. Through the years we've had several lectionary groups that have met in various places, and somehow we always gravitated towards Kmart's, Kmart food courts. We could have gone to many places. We could have gone to that cool breakfast place over in Turkey Creek. We could have gone to Shoney's. I think we even tried that a couple of times. But we always kind of came back to the Kmart, super Kmart food courts, because one, they had a breakfast that you could eat for like a couple of bucks, and two, because it kind of kept us grounded. And there was one time where we were talking about the wise men story for, you know, because we were trying to figure out what we were going to preach about on Sunday morning. And this man, there was this group of men who, you know, old men who met, you know, every week, and they were kind of our hecklers, you know. This one time this guy turns to us and says, "Hey, you want to have some fun with your kids?" And you just looked at him and said, "Yeah." And he said,
"Sounds like me."
Ask them to give you the names of the seven dwarves. And we were all like, "Okay." And then he said, Yeah, and then you ask them what the names of the three wise men were. Now, I think I know where he was going with this. He was of a generation that's like, you know, okay, the kids these days, they know Disney stuff, but they don't know the Bible. So, you know, I kind of know where he was going with that. So, but you didn't just let that go. I remember that. You did not let that go.
Well, because what he said was, and I said, and this is a terrible truth that you are now hearing a confession from. If you're not in my church, I really don't care. I don't mind just telling you the truth. If you're in my church, I'm going to try and be patient and loving and a pastoral. I didn't know this guy. He was part of the bingo group that gathered after we would do our lectionary group. They would interrupt us. We'd be right in the middle of a really deep theological bingo conversation, and you'd hear, senior bingo, time to get going. And so this guy, what he said was, they won't know that it's Gaspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. And I said something along the lines of, yeah, that's not really right. That's all biblical
Most
tradition.
Most of us would just say,
really,
ha, 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 thanks, guy. Thanks, dude. And return to our conversation. But no, Mark Flynn challenged him.
Kind of stuff just drives me crazy. I'll just make up things and say it's biblical. But that's what we're talking about today. It's amazing how much of the Bible we don't know.
Yeah.
We just talk about as if we do. Go back and read the story. I mean, we're talking about the Christmas story. One of my favorite things to ask people is, what does the innkeeper say in the biblical story? And they immediately have an answer. What is it, Steve?
Do you have any money?
You have a Visa? No, they'll say, oh, the innkeeper said, I'm sorry, there's no room in the inn. No, it doesn't say that. There is no innkeeper in the Bible. You know why we think that's what an innkeeper said? Because we have children's pageants, and we have to find as many roles for children as we can in the children's pageant. So somebody's always the innkeeper, and we assign him the role that says, the Bible says, and there was no room for them in the end. So we give that line out.
I love seeing Mark get wound up.
We don't read the Bible.
I just love it. Okay. Hey, we're heading down the home stretch here. So biblical marriage, Mark,
right.
Is it one man and one, it's one man and one woman, right?
This is actually obviously much more, and had this conversation a lot in the last few years. People who say that, you know what they're getting at. Well, the Adam and Eve story, that's their go-to. Yes, but go back, even if you want to ignore the fact that the Adam and Eve story is the second of two creation stories and a parabolic story, go back and look at the Bible. What do you have? Abraham had multiple wives and multiple concubines. You have stories in the Bible where a man was married to a woman and then owned slaves that he had children with. So not just concubines even, but slaves. You have man who has multiple wives, polygamy. You have man and his raped victim that he is told to marry legally. You have a male soldier and a prisoner of war. You have all kinds of options. In fact, even by the time you get to the New Testament, you'll notice that multiple wives is so commonplace that they actually had to say a bishop. One of the criteria for being a bishop is you have to be the husband of one wife. It's so commonplace to have multiple wives that they have to say, okay, in this case, we want you to just have one because we don't want your loyalty to be split. So no, the biblical idea of marriage is not just one man, one woman, but it's whatever the culture of that day believed. And most of the time, it's,
and that's what, you know, wives. One of the things that, if I may pontificate a bit here, it's one of the things that drives me a little crazy about the current debate going on in the church right now around sexuality is that, you know, a lot of the pressure in the United Methodist Church to exclude LGBTQIA persons is based in out of churches in Africa that are more conservative, churches in the Philippines, and yet we have problems in the fact that we have bishops serving in Africa who have multiple wives. And nobody seems to care about that. So, you know, because we don't want to, it's so complicated and so ugly and so self-serving in all these ways. I really, you know, just love people. That's all I care about. Love is all we need, Mark. Sounds like a song. Hey, we're going to wrap up quick here. We're going to start. This is like kind of the we've been through all of these, haven't we?
The lightning round. We have two. We have a couple more we can get to.
When you die, you turn into an angel.
I mean, you know where this comes from. It's sweet. But no, it's just wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Biblical. Angels are a different thing altogether, right? Angels are kind of, you know, heavenly beings, and they don't really look like the, you know, the guy in a white robe with wings and stuff. It's, if you look in Ezekiel or in Isaiah or stuff, you know, there's some kind of ghastly descriptions of what angels look like with, you know, seven heads and 40 eyes and stuff like that.
It's really interesting. People don't realize that the whole understanding around angels is actually a statement about humanity too. That when God created some objects, some things that are fully material but not spiritual, right? Like this table I'm sitting at, or the microphone, or a rock. You know, those are physical objects, material objects, but not spiritual. God created some objects that are spiritual, some beings that are spiritual, the angelic hosts that celebrate and glorify God. And that's what made humanity so cool. Go back and read the book of Hebrews, that humans managed to be both, dun, 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 physical and spiritual. That you are more than just your physical body. And that's the whole point, is angels fill that realm of how we try to describe that which is not on the opposite end of rocks and tables and chairs. They are the spiritual realm.
So I think,
without material.
I'm looking over the list, and I think that is it. Is that it? Is that all of them? Did we cover them all? Yay! Okay.
10.
So the bottom line, Mark, I think to me what all this means is that the Bible, it's not that it's wrong. We're not saying, oh, it's all wrong, you know, it's all not factual. It's pointing at a kind of a truth that that I think is lost in modern conversations and modern thinking. And that is it. This is a saying that was attributed to Mark Twain, but it could have been said by anybody. Is all stories are true, some actually happened. We're not really talking about things that had to happen. In fact, you know, when Luke starts out, when the Gospel of Luke starts out, he uses a word. The writer of Luke uses a word talking about what the gospel actually is, and he uses a Greek word called diegesis, which doesn't occur anywhere else, I don't think, in the New Testament. And that means we got to pay attention to it. And I had a seminary professor point this out one time. It says it's very interesting to say what he didn't use. He could have used all kinds of other Greek words. He could have used historia, for instance. He didn't. He used this word diegesis, which means kind of an orderly account. It's not meant to be exactly true. Jesus said these exact words. Jesus did these exact same things. But it's a story. And out of the story, we learn truths that are beyond, way beyond the facts. Right? Yes?
In the same way that Jesus told parables, right? Something can be true when Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's a true statement. It just doesn't happen to be factual or historical. And then we're not saying that none of the things in the Gospels are not factual. Of course they were, and Jesus did live, and we're not saying that. But exactly what Steve's talking about, go back and read the opening to the Gospel of John. You know what you're going to see in the second chapter? Is they take a story that in the other three Gospels, the cleansing of the temple, which happens as Jesus enters in that last week of his life, John has no qualms whatsoever about ripping that story out of its proper place and sticking it right there in chapter 2 at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. He's not trying to pull one over on the readers. He's not saying, ooh, maybe they won't notice. He's saying that this story, I believe, helps define who Jesus is and the ministry that's going to happen. And nobody, I mean, the early church weren't stupid. They knew that. They knew that this wasn't history, that it's gospel. And the goal of a gospel is to get you to believe. It's not to report events in a particular order. It's to get us to agree
and
that Jesus Christ
that
is Lord.
That there is life to be found in following Jesus. It's, I think that's the you know, this is what we've got to keep in mind. This is what we got to get in focus. Instead of debating all these things about did this happen, did that happen, and, you know, and what does it mean? Do we need to split as a church because we believe this, that, and the other? It's about love. It is about love, 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 love. And that's where I kind of get wound up, Mark, you know? That's where I, yeah. Yeah, I love it when you get wound up. So
I love it.
Yeah, so with that, we're going to kind of wrap this up. Gosh, for those of you who stuck it out after my disclaimer at the beginning, well, I have real questions about. Well, you should just be more busy. That's all I got to say.
And if you call Steve now, you'll get a free gift.
Yeah.
See who made it to the end. Email Steve.
I could
Steve.
Say that you would be. I could put you on the air. I could give out my phone number and put you on the air, but this isn't live, so that wouldn't really help anything.
Hey, you email. If you held out this long, email me,
go.
And I'll send you a free Bible study.
Who would not take you up on that offer? Yeah. Who would not take you up on that
offer? Who doesn't want that?
So, yes, thank you all for listening. We do want you to, you know, like and subscribe and tell other people about this. And we'd love to hear from you one way or another. You know, we post this stuff on the website. We post it in the Apple podcast store, where we'd really like a review because that helps. That helps get the word out. Leave a review. A nice one, please. But be honest, you know, this is important. Definitely social media. If something, you know, touched your heart or made you laugh or something, please, you know, just share this podcast. And we're hoping that this will be a kind of an earthly, you know, very, very accessible way of accessing the passion that Christian leaders bring to these jobs. You know, this stuff is really important, and it's fascinating, and it can be fun. Anyway, I'll stop rambling. Mark, you have a great week. Everybody out there, and
thanks, you too.
And you have a good week too. We'll talk to you later.